Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Asaf Gavron, American-Israeli Cooperative Enterprise visiting scholar, a writer, novelist, translator, and musician, and author of several books, including Ice, Sex in the Cemetery, and Eating Standing Up. The topic of his presentation will be, How Do You Say Banana Fish in Hebrew? This program, co-sponsored by the Hannah and Natan Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies and the University of Nebraska at Omaha Department of English, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 16, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Moshe Gershovich, Professor of History and the Director of the Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
I would like to say how happy I am to introduce to the community and to the UNO community our visiting American-Israeli cultural exchange visiting Israeli professor, Asaf Gavron. Some of you are taking his class, and some of you may have heard him already in other occasions. And this is the second time that we are having an Israeli professor, a visiting Israeli professor coming to campus in 2 years. And I think that it's part of the momentum that we are gaining at the Schwalb Center in advancing programs in Israel and Jewish studies. And I think the lecture tonight is going to be particularly interesting for people interested in literature and in the way that literature is transmitted from one language to the other and the challenges, especially with a language like Hebrew, which is a rather minimalist kind of language, when it comes from English, which is a language that has developed over hundreds of years from a variety of places, whereas Hebrew, of course, is a language that was revived over a little more than a century and which is still in use on a regular basis by a fairly small number of people overall in the world, about by now 7.5 million people out of a population of about 7 billion. So there are all sorts of challenges which I'm sure Asaf is going to share with us. So again, it's my pleasure to host Asaf here for the year, and I hope that you'll continue to attend our events, support our events. We do a lot of things, I'm always happy to see as many of you as we can bring to UNO. Thank you.
Thank you, Moshe. And hello, everyone. Good evening. This is a little bit of a problematic situation here because I'm going to explain to an American English-speaking audience about that who don't speak Hebrew for the most part, about translating from English into Hebrew. So when I'll have to present, for example, the choices I have to make from one word to another or one sentence to another, I'll have to kind of translate back to English the options. So it's going to be a kind of a translation on translation talk. I hope it will succeed. We'll see how it goes. First thing, as Moshe said, is to understand a little bit about Hebrew. It is originally an ancient language, one of the most ancient that there are, one of the first. But as Moshe said, it was revived about 130 years ago, together more or less with the revival of Zionism, with the idea of Jews returning to their homeland in then Palestine, today the State of Israel. The language, the Hebrew language, was revived, and since then, it became a kind of a new language. So, I mean, it's based on the ancient language that we can read in the Old Testament, but and it uses a lot of words from there and the basic structure from there, but it's full of new words and new uses of the language, and it keeps evolving. It's still evolving as a language, 130 years old. It's still gaining new words, new influences, influenced by, for example, the Arabic, which is our neighboring language, and from the same linguistic root, the Semite, and from the different immigrations that came into Israel with their original languages. For example, the Russian is a huge, the latest big immigration in the 90s after the fall of communism and the breakup of the Soviet Union. About 1 million Russian Jews immigrated to Israel, and they brought with them another set of words, influences, and so on. And also English, of course, as the major cultural force in the world. People watch it in the movies, TV, read it, hear it all the time. Israelis speak relatively good English, so that's another source of influence on the language. So it always changes, and specifically in relation to translated fiction, this feature of the new Hebrew is shows itself in new translations that are published recently to books that have been originally translated only 30 or 40 years ago. And I did a couple of these new translations, second translations to novels, to books. And I'll get to that later in the lecture, to some of those examples. I mean, if I give one example, Portnoy's Complaint, which is the Philip Roth novel, was published in English originally in 69, I think. The first Hebrew translation was published in the early 70s at some time. And my new translation, which is here, was published 2009. So only exactly 36 years between the editions. And if you think of English, if you read Portnoy's Complaint now in English, it's totally fine. It's the English is readable. It's it's authentic. It's still funny and engaging and exciting in the same way it was in 69. Well, if you read the original translation in Hebrew, it would look strange. It would look old Hebrew. So that's kind of an example how fast Hebrew is changing, and that presents a lot of challenges and problems and kind of discussion points for translators and editors. So, a word, before I start, a word about translation. There was an article in the New Yorker a couple of years ago, 2012, a long article, 6-page article about translating the first line of Albert Camus' L'Étranger, the Stranger. Even the title of the novel was first The Outsider in the original translation, and then later it became The Stranger. And this first line, which is about the mother of the protagonist dying, I can't read it in French, but basically it says, "Today mother died," or "Mother died today." And the whole article is about the choice of the word mother as opposed to maman, which is the French word, which is more like mommy or mom. Mother is a bit strict, is a bit cold or detached. Maman is closer to, is warmer in a way, but mommy sounds a child, like a child, and mom also. So The original translation was Mother Died Today, and then later they reverted to the French word, maman, assuming that most English readers would understand this word and the different meaning it has to mother. And then another part of the article is about the order of the sentence. Mother died today, but in French it's actually today mother died, which is less smooth maybe in English, but actually it has a meaning. Because, at least as this writer explains, the death of the mother disrupted the day. So it starts with today mother died. And his conclusion is that none of the four languages translations available are correct, but he would do it today maman died. So just a little example of this one sentence, which of course the first sentence of the novel and sets the tone and you know is the basis on which the rest of the novel is laid. I had a couple of ideas for the title of this lecture. Eventually it's how do you say banana fish in Hebrew. Another option was Midtown is not the center of town, and I'll get to that later, but I think you can imagine the question there. And the other one was as or behind thoughts and arguments, and we will get to that also later with an example I have. So here in this lecture I'm going to speak quite freely about a few stories related to my translation work in the context of the Hebrew language, the choice of language, the choice of style, the different considerations and the different dilemmas, and also some discussions and conflicts and arguments I had with various editors and publishers throughout the years. I chose a few examples from books I translated. I will present them and read them. And as I said, try to explain the Hebrew as much as I can. And I will focus on examples that I had particular difficulties in the translations. For example, awkward language, intentionally awkward language in the original English. Dialect, for example, southern dialect from the south of the U.S., upper-class British English in another example, and so on. And as I said, in addition to quoting the examples in the books, I will read a few email exchanges that I had with editors and publishers that I think enlighten the whole work of translation. Okay, so a few words about myself. As a translator, I translated a little over 20 books. I will go through them quickly so you get the picture. Dashiell Hammett, The Maltese Falcon. This is from the most recent to the earlier. Dashiell Hammett, The Maltese Falcon is a new translation that I explained before. J.K. Rowling, The Casual Vacancy. Nathan Englander, What We Talk About When We Talk About Anne Frank. Jonathan Ames, Wake Up, Sir. David Foster Wallace, Girl with Curious Hair. Franz Kafka, Metamorphosis. Of course, he didn't write it in English. I translated a comic book version by Peter Cooper, an American comic artist. Philip Roth, Portnoy's Complaint. Donald Harrington, Quiring of the Trees. Nick Laird, Utterly Monkey. Donald Harrington, When Angels Rest. Ed Joslin and Andrew McEwen, The Long March. Donald Harrington, The Architecture of the Arkansas Ozarks. I will speak about Harrington later. He's a wonderful writer from Arkansas. James Hawes, Speak for England. Jonathan Safran Foer, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Tristan Egolf, Skirt and Fiddle. Audrey Niffenegger, The Time Traveler's Wife. J.D. Salinger, Nine Stories. Richard Condon, The Manchurian Candidate. Jonathan Safran Foer, Everything is Illuminated.
Quentin Tarantino, Pulp Fiction, the script. James Hawes, A White Merc with Fins, and Douglas Copeland, Life After God. So that spans, I think Life After God was 94, so around 20 years, a little less. I'm also a novelist, a writer, so I also have that experience of translation from the other side, translated to a different language, to English too, and also which I can read and check and discuss, but also to languages that I don't know, like German and French and Italian and so on, which I cannot read and have to trust the publishers in those countries. Two translation projects that I'll mention that are not part of this list are one, my own novel, Almost Dead, published originally in Hebrew, and I did the translation with a co-translator, an English guy who helped me with the English. If we have time, I'll get to that later. And recently, the most recent project is a Natalie Portman film version of a book by Amos Oz, A Tale of Love and Darkness, that she wrote the script in English based on the English translation of the Hebrew original, and I translated the script from English to Hebrew because the film was shot in Hebrew, in the original language, only a couple of months ago, and is expected to hit the screens early next year. Okay. Another thing that I should mention in my biography that I think is relevant is that I'm a son to English immigrants. I grew up in an English-speaking house. My parents still, after 50 years in Israel, speak Hebrew in a very heavy British accent and make a lot of mistakes in Hebrew. And Hebrew was actually my second language, although it doesn't sound that way. I never heard at home Hebrew, and to this day my parents speak English between them and to us, to their children. So I think for this reason I'm not, my Hebrew is actually not perfect. It's not totally correct. I mean, it could be also that I wasn't a very good student in school, but I say that it's because of my parents. And I think that it's okay. There are people that their job is to know the perfect language. They correct me, the proofreaders, the editors, and it doesn't embarrass me or bother me too much. But I think that also that because my Hebrew was never perfect, for me, as a translator, first and foremost, I feel that I need to be loyal to the author, to his style or hers, to the atmosphere, to the story. And also, by the way, as an author, I rate the story above the language. I know there are many writers who disagree with that, but for me, if it sounds good, if it works, even if it's on the expense of being correct, for me, that's fine. But this is also the point of friction. This is where the proofreaders and the editors start to ask questions and to disagree. And this is their job. My job is to translate. So I'll move on to the first example. The first example is J.D. Salinger from Nine Stories, but actually not Banana Fish, not A Perfect Day for Banana Fish. Although today was a perfect day here in Omaha. The story I'm going to talk about is To Esme with Love and Squalor. A few years ago, a short time after my new translation of Salinger was published, 2005, I met this publisher in Israel, Yuda Meltzer, who's a very esteemed veteran, known publisher, and he told me that after the book was published, he's also a huge Salinger fan, and he
is known to be one. And he told me that then when the book was published, he went into the bookstore and he pulled out the copy of my new translation and he opened the book in a specific page and he looked for a specific line and he read it and he didn't like what he read and he put it back in the shelf and went out of the store. Now, this was the line. And as I said, it's from the story To Esme with Love and Squalor, which is probably this one with A Perfect Day to Banana Fish. I think they are the two most notable Salinger stories and the best, in my opinion. And both of them are quite perfect stories. So the line goes like this. "Goodbye," Esme said. "I hope you return from the war with all your faculties intact." Now, I'm going to give you the different translation to that sentence, and I'm going to try to translate them back to English so you know what it's about. The original translation, 1979, by a translator called Judith Dorf. I don't know her. But, by the way, a small anecdote, those nine stories in that original translation were translated by three different translators, and one of them was Aviv Meltzer, which is the brother of the guy I just told you about, who didn't like the translation. But his brother didn't translate this one. So she wrote, "Shalom amra Esme, ani mikava shetachzor mehamilchama kshekol ksharecha lo nizakim," which I would translate as something like, "I hope you come back, you return from the war with all your skills undamaged." So that sounds quite old, quite not up to date, quite dated. So I went and I looked for the book, for my version, and I opened the book and I read it, and after I read it I said, I didn't translate it this way, because not always I read everything and you not always note everything and every line. But this is what it says in the published version of my translation, 2005. It says, "Litraot amra Esme, ani mikava shetachzor mehamilchama bari veshalem begufcha ubenafshecha." Something like, "I hope you return from the war healthy and whole in body and in mind." So after I saw this, after I met this guy, and after I saw this, and I said, this is not me, I looked for my original translation, for my translation that I submitted to the publisher, which I suspected was not as published, and I couldn't find it. So I said, okay, I'll translate it now. How different would it be from my submitted translation? So what I did now, a couple of weeks ago, I did, "Leitraot amra Esme, ani mekava shetachzor mehamilchama kshekol hachalakim shelcha bimkomam. I hope you return from the war with all your parts in place." And after that, I found that 2005 version that I wrote, that I translated, and it was a little different. And it was, "Leitraot amra Esme, ani mekava shetachzor mehamilchama kshehakol yoshev b'makom. I hope you return from war with everything sitting in place." Now, yoshev b'makom, sitting in place, may sound a little weird, but it's a kind of a term in Hebrew. And this anecdote, I think, shows a few things. First, that you have readers that you will never please. Second, that there are many ways to translate one sentence. Even the same person in 2005 and in 2014 translated differently. Third, that you have all kinds of considerations when you translate, clarity, being faithful to the original, flowing, how flowing it is, and correctness, of course, which is the reason my proofreader and editor changed it eventually. And the fourth thing is that sometimes you are credited for translations that you actually didn't right, and you don't even agree with the way it's translated. And in this case, I tend to agree with Yehuda Meltzer, the guy that I met. I think that the chosen sentence
was a bit, was might be the clearest and the most correct in Hebrew, but it also, in a way, too safe. And in that way, it kind of doesn't serve the writer, the author. And sometimes I think myself is, if this writer, J.D. Salinger in this example, if he would write Hebrew, how would he write it? And I don't think he would have written it in a way that it was published. And I think with everything sitting in place, the way I did it, it might not be 100% correct. It might sound a little weird, but it's the closest to all your faculties intact. Next example is Jonathan Safran Foer. Now, this book, Everything is Illuminated, is one of the characters is an Ukrainian guy who speaks very bad English. And I'll read from the original English, just a few lines from the beginning of the book. My legal name is Alexander Perchov, but all of my many friends dub me Alex, because that is a more flaccid to utter version of my legal name. Mother dubs me Alexei Stop Spleening Me, because I am always spleening her. If you want to know why I am always spleening her, it is because I am always elsewhere with my friends and disseminating so much currency and performing so many things that can spleen a mother. Father used to dub me Shapka for the fur hat I would don even in the summer month. He ceased dubbing me that because I ordered him to cease dubbing me that. It sounded boyish to me, and I have always thought of myself as very potent and generative. I have many, many girls, believe me, and they all have different names for me. One dubs me baby, not because I am a baby, but because she attends to me. Another dubs me all night. Do you want to know why? So that's the original. Now, this is a translation that in Israel I'm always approached about, and I always hear things like, how could you take this broken English into Hebrew? How could you express that? And people seem to be particularly impressed with how I did that, which it kind of works in Hebrew. But my answer is always that actually this was one of the easiest translations or parts of the translations for me to do, because what he did, Jonathan Safran Foer, the writer, he used a dictionary and a thesaurus, and he used words that have a similar meaning, but it's not the right meaning for that use. For example, dubbing me instead of calling me, or disseminate cash instead of a currency instead of spending money, and so on. So what I did, I went to the dictionary, and you know, when you see a word in a dictionary, you have different options for different contexts. And like Safran Foer used the wrong context to his text, I picked up the wrong context word. So actually it was quite easy to do. And sometimes it doesn't work exactly, so you have to compromise. So currency, I didn't really use the word for currency. I used money, monies in plural. So you kind of find your way. But I think that beyond the specific words, this translation, this example, kind of shows us something important in translation, which is to transfer the atmosphere of the book. What the author tried to do, his style. And in this case, it's a comic kind of fun way to show us this foreigner who tries to speak English, but he doesn't really know how to do it. And his bad English is a tool It's a literary tool in this book. And once you understand this, you concentrate on that when you try to translate it. And you can, in this case, you can really go wild and fool around and have fun with it. And I really did enjoy translating this character. And I think trying to maintain the character as the author intended to. Okay, another example now. Donald Harrington, I mentioned him earlier, is not well known. He's from Arkansas. He published 12 or 13 novels. He died a couple of years ago. He published 13 novels that all take place in the fictional town in Arkansas called Staymore. That's the name of the town. And it's all about the different characters there. And he goes back again and again to the same town, but tells a different story each time. And I really recommend him. He's kind of unjustly unknown. And he has this little small community of followers. I totally recommend him. Now, I'll give just one example, one word that I kind of struggled with translating. And the word was maters. And I didn't understand what it's about. It took me a few readings to understand that he was talking about tomatoes. He's from Arkansas, and he uses the dialect. Like with maters, the whole book is filled with this kind of broken words, incorrect, and so on. And what I chose in Hebrew was gvania, because agvania is the word for tomato, and I kind of broke it. But people who I talked to, you know, they didn't always get it. So I wasn't sure the choice was correct in this case. And I'll just quote a short email from the editor called Aliza that I worked with on this one. She says, "We have a problem in our language to do something parallel to the type of American language that these guys speak in the book. For example, in Harry Potter," she also edited the translation of Harry Potter. "In Harry Potter, there's a guy called Hagrid. Do you remember him? He also had a language of his own. So we invented a language in Hebrew for him, and I think it came out nicely. But here it doesn't fit. So what we have left in Hebrew is this shortenings that you used," because this is what I did. I shortened the words like he shortened in English. And it doesn't always work. So what I did is that sometimes I fixed it by hearing how it's really logical that they would speak, I left. And when it wasn't that way, I gave up or I changed the words. So that's more or less what I did. Okay, now I'm going to quote a couple more email exchanges. Because this example, again, shows me that you can and you should challenge the correct language in order to stay faithful to the original. This is the way Harrington wrote, in dialect and incorrectly and in broken words, and this is what he would have done in Hebrew, and this is what I tried to do. And of course I accepted her reservations in some of the cases, but eventually we used quite a lot of this language. So now to a book where I had much less cooperation and agreement with the editor. It's a book called Speaking for England by an English writer called James Hawes, and the book is about a kind of imagined England that is discovered suddenly on an island because a plane crashed there and this community remained there, but the plane crashed in the 50s, so this community of Englishmen, kind of upper class Englishmen from the 50s, is discovered suddenly in the 2000s. By the way, by a contestant in a reality show. And okay, so I'll just read quickly. Asaf Shalom, I got your example of the translation, and my eyes went black. Chashchuenai, it's a term in Hebrew. I don't know if you have it in English. I remember your previous. I translated for her a previous book by this writer. I remembered your previous translation as great, both for the accuracy in the translation and the level of Hebrew. And here you have so many problems of so many kinds that I thought you might have sent us the wrong file. Okay. So I replied to her. I checked, and this is my last file. And then I go to explain that I think that I'm as good as I was 10 years before, if not better, with the gained experience that I had as a translator and a writer. And I say that I'm not sure that you or the editor realized the differences between this book and the previous book. And the main issue in this book is England of these days opposed England of the 50s. And the tension between the periods is what pulls the plot and the language. And I give a few examples. See here is not look that we have today, so it cannot be translated as just look. Does it puggery is a curse that is old, and then we cannot use, again, as that they wanted to use, but I preferred behind, that combines the old language and the actual meaning of the word. And then I say, I will not go over everything and so on. And then she says, she wrote to me back and she says, I'm sure it was not simple to translate this book, and the editor is aware of that, and he assumes that you made your choices and you have your explanations, and he didn't want to iron the translation and to turn it to normal language in any cost. But at the same time, you have to remember that eventually a translation is judged by itself as an independent text. The reader, the Hebrew reader, cannot know that the words look here comes to, or see here comes to represent England from the 50s. And if he knows some English and so on and so on and so forth, but it's a good point that she makes, that a text is judged by as an independent text. And she says about the idea to change us with behind. She said us is actually not a very new word. And then I said I agree that the text is independent, but I stick to my explanations. I think that the reader, okay, he doesn't have to know that it's from the 50s, but he has to kind of be aware that something is different here, something is weird. He has to raise an eyebrow, and then later he will realize it's English from the 50s. And so on and so forth. And then after a few more exchanges, she writes to me, Asaf Shalom, unfortunately, our editor told me today that he gives up because it's too difficult for him to edit the translation. And then they got a new one, and I didn't hear from him. And they offered me at some point to read his version, but I... At that stage, I was too tired with this book, and I didn't. Okay, probably the last one that we have time for is a writer. That will be the last one. a writer called David Foster Wallace. David Foster Wallace, you might know him, is a novelist, short story writer, an essayist, American, from the Midwest originally. I think Illinois, not sure exactly where. And he sadly committed suicide about 5 years ago. And he was, I was actually a huge fan of his in English, and I tried to convince Israeli publishers to publish him for many years. And only after he committed suicide and kind of became more famous, this publisher decided to publish his a kind of a collection of essays and stories. I did the essays, and it was very popular in Israel, and after that they published two more books by his, and he became really successful in Israel, which is I'm very proud of and happy about. And one issue I had there was Midtown, that I mentioned earlier, that the editor changed to the city center, which is not. Although it's Midtown, it's not the center of town. Usually downtown, in a kind of, if you think about the logic, it's strange that downtown is actually the real center. I had to explain to her the thing about Midtown. And then we had an argument about a sentence that goes like this. You can also hear the wind in the cornfields just south. It sounds roughly the way light surf sounds when you're two dunes back from the shore. So yes, actually it's a nice example to finish with, because you all know what the cornfields are about. So she told me about the dunes. She said, I translated it as someone who sits on the shore and hears two waves inside. And she says, I thought about the dunes. I think there is no connection, no relation to surfing, to the actual waves, but to the sound of the waves that you hear from afar when you sit on the beach, two sand dunes from the shore. Because, and I said, and she said, if you are surfing in the sea, the waves are close to you. And he's trying to describe a sound that is kind of far from you, like a cornfield. So I said, you know, you didn't understand me. I'm convinced that he's speaking about someone speaking on the shore itself and hearing the waves in the second wave from the beach, and not someone sitting two sand dunes from the beach. Do you realize the difference? I know it's a very, very small matter, and there's no need to argue about it for hours, but it's important for me to explain and that you understand what I meant. I really think it's this way. What is two dunes? The beach, on the beach there are no dunes of sand, although I think I might be wrong there. And I cannot imagine the distance of two dunes on the beach, maybe in the desert. But I think he speaks about the waves. And the waves have the different, the first and the second and so on. Anyway, she replies, yeah, now I understand you. And you could be right. We need to read it again in the original and to see how it works. But at the same time, he wrote the word dunes. So maybe we should leave it dunes and not analyze it. And the reader will understand what he understands, he or she understands, like you and me understood two different things. And I think it's very beautiful that a text allows it. And I think this is a great sentence to finish with. I'll read it again. if he wrote Dunes, we should leave Dunes and not analyze it, and the reader will understand what he understands. Like you and I understood two different things, and it's so beautiful that the text allows it. Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions.
Can you share with us a little bit the process by which there is a decision what to translate by whom? Is it something that you propose to a publisher? Is it something that a publisher would approach you? Is it a little bit of both?
Yes, it's a little bit of everything. My first offer to translate came after I wrote an article. I was a journalist, and I interviewed Douglas Copeland, a Canadian writer, and this woman wrote to me that she just purchased the rights to translate a book by him from English, and she liked my article and she wanted me to translate it, and that was the first time. You know, it depends on your status as a translator. The more you translate, the more you translate successful books and known books, then your status grows, and then you're approached by publishers who think also that it fits your style. And sometimes you can come up with ideas, like I just told about David Foster Wallace, which I was a big fan of, and he didn't have a Hebrew translation, and I sent books by him to publishers, some of which never returned my copies, and I said, you must translate this guy, and only after a few years. But then actually I was offered the job then when the publisher did buy the rights to him, because I published a kind of obituary in a Hebrew website in Ynet, and I said, listen, this guy just died. You don't know him because he was never translated into Hebrew, but you must know him. And because I wrote this, this girl went, read him in Hebrew, loved him, decided to buy the rights, and offered me to translate the essays in that book. And technically how the process works, just to answer that part of the question, is that an Israeli publisher will buy rights to translate a book. It's not huge sums usually, unless it's a very famous and successful book, and then there could be an auction between competing publishers, and then the price. I know that the highest price paid by a publisher in Israel for rights is $55,000. That's a lot for Israel, and it's very hard to return this investment, because on top of that you have to pay the translator and all the expenses that you have when you create a book. But it's a very small amount compared to numbers that you have here. Here you get to millions for rights. But what happens is that a publisher will buy the rights because it was a success in its original language, because it's a famous writer that they already translated his previous book, because a good agent sold them the idea and showed them this new book that came out, for various reasons, and there are all the book fairs where all the business happens, and that's where the publishers hear about new books, and then they decide to get the translation rights, and after they buy that, they look for the right translator.
How about the classics, Asaf? Shakespeare, Dickens, or Jane Austen? Are those available in Hebrew translations now? Do you ever deal with that kind of work?
I don't. I think that it's partly related to what I said about my maybe attention to language. Things like Shakespeare, I don't dare touch. But yes, they are available in Hebrew, and they are, like I said, there are new translations coming out. There's been a Jane Austen, a few by Jane Austen, translated quite famously by novelist called Irit Linur. She's quite a known figure in Israeli literature and culture and a little bit politics. She's on this radio show. She's very annoying. She is a good writer, and she translated a few of Jane Austen novels in recent years. We have everything. Israel is the Israeli publishing market is relatively very big relative to the number of readers. As Moshe said, there are about 7 or 8 million people who actually speak the language. Which is, by the way, more than languages like Finnish or Danish, but it's still a very small number. And relative to the number and to the market, Israel is considered a very big reading culture, and it's the size of the publishing market is the same as the publishing market in Brazil, which has 150 million citizens and speakers of the language. So that's we have the classics and we have a lot.
You said that your first translation came because you were a journalist. Had you written a novel before that? Before your first translation?
No.
You had not. Oh, so what I was, that's interesting because why? Because of your journalism, the woman thought that your skill was there. Because are there different skills that a novelist might have from a translator, a good novelist and a good translator?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that in order to be a good translator, you must be a good writer. I guess the best translators can actually probably be novelists. I rate my writing in a way, if such a thing can such a comparison can be made, more than my translation. It's more important for me, and I think it's more creative. Although it's less creative than some people think, But translation, I look at it as a job, because the text is there. I didn't invent it. The story was invented by someone else, and my role is to serve this writer and to bring his text to a different language. Now there is creativity involved in this, and I think that the lecture and my example shows that, but. It's a little different skill, but I mean it's needed. And you're right. That woman who read my article probably identified something in my writing that she liked. In addition to understanding that I like this writer and I will probably do a good job translating specifically him. I think that it's you need to be a good writer, but it's still kind of two separate worlds.
Just as a follow-up on the previous thought, has it ever happened that when you were translating someone, you thought to yourself, I would have written it better than he did, and try to change as a result to what it should be rather than what it was?
Yeah. Well, the answer is yes. And actually, the two books that I didn't feel this way at all, because I'll go back a little. When you translate, you really get to know the text. Probably, I don't know if better than the author, probably not as, but as much, close to as much as the author knows this text, because you read it again and you write it. You write it again and again and again. And you know it and you find the mistakes and you say, first of all, sometimes there are mistakes, things that should be corrected. But also, you know, he went too long here. I wouldn't have done this. I wouldn't have done that, and so on. So yeah, I do get this. The two books that I, with every read, I felt more respect to the writer and enjoyed it even more, are Portnoy's Complaint by Philip Roth and Salinger's Nine Stories. And I think those are just wonderful books. And the experience of translating actually reinforced my respect to those books. But probably all the others I would have done differently. This one, Nathan Englander, there is a story here that I... Don't tell it if you meet this writer, but I really hated it. And actually, he's a nice guy, and we're friendly, and we talked on the phone, and I had a long conversation with him on this story, and I tried to explain. There were I won't go into too much detail, but it was about Israel, about something in Israel, and the guy knows he's Jewish, and he lived in Jerusalem. I respect that. I don't think that you have to be Israeli in order to write about Israel, but he got it drawn with historical facts, and the story was kind of half realist and half fantasy, and the whole realist thing was not real. So I didn't like that, and we had a long conversation, but he insisted on everything. He wouldn't budge, he wouldn't move, and eventually it's his decision, and he is the author, and you know, I tried to convince him, but when I couldn't, then I gave up and did it like he wanted. Sometimes you do a little fixes without asking, without discussing with the author. And the last example I give related to this question is my own translation to English, that I think that we improved the book. Together also with the English guy, which I should credit, the guy called James Lever, which he's also a writer. And he doesn't know Hebrew. I did the Hebrew to English translation, but then we worked on the English. And I think we did some improvements on the original. So actually, I think Almost Dead in English is better than Tanin Pigua in Hebrew. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Asaf Gavron, American-Israeli Cooperative Enterprise Visiting Scholar, a writer, novelist, translator, and musician, and author of several books, including Ice, Sex in the Cemetery, and Eating Standing Up. The topic of his presentation was, How Do You Say Banana Fish in Hebrew? This program, co-sponsored by the Hannah and Natan Schwalb Center for Israel and Jewish Studies and the University of Nebraska at Omaha Department of English, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 16, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Charlie Reed, UNO Media Relations Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.